President Obama lays out his long-term plan to reduce the deficit.
What should we be watching for?
Marketplace Midday Update is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
From APM, American Public Media in Los Angeles, hello, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. You're listening to the Midday Update from Marketplace.org. It is Wednesday, April 13th.
Coming up, we'll talk to two economists about the president's deficit reduction plan. Also, how are consumers reacting to rising gas prices?
And I'll take a quiz about the world's biggest cities.
Can't wait to see how you do, Steve. All those stories just ahead on the Marketplace Midday Update.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
Let's start with the president's big deficit speech today. He's expected to call for changes to entitlement programs as well as cuts to defense spending and tax increases. This is the Democratic counter to last week's Republican plan for long-term deficit reduction.
We're going to get two views of the plan now. We'll start with Mark Zandi, chief economist with Moody's Analytics. Good morning.
Good morning, Jeremy.
Well, what will you be watching for in the president's speech today?
Specifics. You know, the president laid out a budget back in February, but it was very light on detail. I'm expecting a lot more information today about the spending cuts, tax increases that he plans to put forward to address our long-term fiscal problems. So I want some meat here.
And if you take what you're expecting from the president, what we're all expecting from the president, and what we've already seen from the Republican Paul Ryan's plan, where do you see the center of the debate heading when it comes to long-term budget changes?
You know, I think the center is pretty close to where the Fiscal Commission that reported out at the end of last year came out on this, and that would include some spending cuts, some entitlement reform, and some tax reform and tax increases. I think Congressman Ryan did shift the debate, however. His emphasis on Medicare and Medicaid probably means that more of the onus of the future budget cutting will be on those programs.
Mark Zandi, chief economist with Moody's Analytics. Thanks so much for your time.
Thank you.
And for another take, let's bring in Richard DeKayser, economist with the Parthenon Group. He's with us as he is each Wednesday from Boston. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, what are you going to be watching for in the president's speech?
Well, I don't think there's going to be a lot here by way of details, but we're going to see a broad philosophical response to the Republican plan. And that's going to entail, as you mentioned already, tax increases. And I think the real purpose here is to distinguish the White House and the Democratic Party from the Republican plan. They're going to breach the topic of revenue enhancements, which is never popular. In following suit, the Republicans also breached some bright red lines by embracing cuts in entitlement programs. So we're starting to see a serious conversation, I think, beginning to roll out.
And when you say revenue enhancements, of course, that's a code word for
yep.
tax increases. Richard, don't we just end up with two plans, though, that don't really have a big chance of getting passed through Congress?
Oh, I think that's absolutely right. It's early in the game. Negotiations often start far apart. That's where we are. And if you want to look underneath these broad philosophical positions, you can always find some numbers. Basically, the Ryan plan gets us down to federal revenues as a share of GDP at about 18% in 10 years. The White House budget coming out earlier this year was closer to 20%, and that two-point difference is where we're going to be talking about taking the government over the course of the next year.
Richard DeKayser, economist with the Parthenon Group, thanks so much.
My pleasure.
The nation's second largest bank, J.P. Morgan Chase, said today it made more money in the first 3 months of the year. Its earnings were up 60% over the same time last year. Now, big banks have been on a profitable tear since the financial crisis.
But there could be some trouble for those financials down the road because people and companies keep holding on to more of their money and not getting loans. Here's Marketplace senior business correspondent Bob Moon.
We aren't borrowing enough, and neither are businesses, which is weighing on bank profits. And for now, addressing that problem is largely out of their hands. So says Jeffrey Hart, a banking analyst at Sandler O'Neill & Partners.
When it comes to loans, it's not so much what the banks can do, it's what the economy can do. You know, if the economy keeps getting stronger and people keep developing higher levels of confidence, we should see loan growth start to pick up again.
There's been some finger-pointing at financial institutions for not lending enough, but Hart says it's not just consumers and businesses who've changed their habits. Banks are leery of drumming up the wrong kind of business.
making underwriting standards too easy, so you're essentially giving people money that probably don't deserve to have the money, and that's where we kind of got in trouble with the last crisis. So to some extent, banks are kind of a victim of economic circumstance.
Now there's a novel thought, the banks as victims. Hart says higher energy prices and global turmoil have put the economy in a soft spot right now, but he expects that picture, along with bank profits, to improve. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
A new survey by the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, the OECD, says men in some countries do far less unpaid household work than men in other countries. The study looks at men and women in 29 of the world's more developed nations and how much time they spent on chores, such as mowing the lawn and doing the dishes, other things like that. Marketplace's Stephen Beard is with us from London with a look at some of this data. Hi, Stephen.
Hello, Steve.
So how did the men in the United States stack up?
Hang your heads in shame. American men spend 3 hours a day on household chores, but that is 1 hour and 40 minutes less than American women. So American women still doing more of the unpaid household work. However, that still makes them much better off than most women in this 29-country survey.
All right. So, Stephen, which countries stood out as having the biggest gender gap?
Right. Portugal and Italy in Europe, men in those countries spend less than 2 hours a day helping out in the home. India, Japan and South Korea are the worst outside, though. Men in those countries spend less than an hour on the household chores. I should add, though, women are not as badly off as these figures may suggest. Here's Simon Chappell, who helped compile the report.
Countries where women work in the paid workforce more, the gender gap in unpaid work is less.
In other words, by and large, when women go out to work, have a paid job, they get more help at home from their menfolk. And just a quick note, Steve, about definitions. This survey classifies shopping as unpaid work, as a chore. Some people might regard shopping as a pleasure. How else do we explain that the French, who famously had the 35-hour week, spend the most time, 32 minutes a day, shopping?
32 minutes. All right. Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Stephen, thank you.
Okay, Steve.
This podcast is supported by Carbonite Pro Online Backup, the automatic backup solution designed for small businesses. Learn more at carbonitepro.com.
To the global perspective now, there's a shortage of parts again, causing Japanese car maker Toyota to halt operations at some of its plants. But the earthquake and tsunami in Japan happened more than a month ago. Shouldn't we have known about all the parts shortages by now? From Tokyo, here's the BBC's Roland Burke.
Auto parts are shipped around the world by sea, but huge container ships move slowly. So once the parts get loaded on ships, they can take several weeks before they reach their final destination. Meaning there were tons of parts already on ships and headed for factories around the world before the tsunami stopped production in northern Japan. It's those parts that have been supplying car factories for the past month and preventing shortages thus far. But now the parts shortages are hitting big auto firms like Toyota, and that could carry on for a while. Masahiro Ito is a government official in northern Japan.
Many factories are repairing their equipment. The stocks are running out. It's difficult to meet orders from around the world. Economic losses are not yet clear, but the delay is problematic.
For Toyota, the shutdowns are a big blow. In Japan alone, it suffered a production loss of 250,000 cars since the disaster. And it says it isn't clear when it's going to be able to return to full capacity. In Tokyo, I'm the BBC's Roland Burke for Marketplace.
More people are moving to big cities all around the world. And how is that shaping the global economy? Well, that's the focus of our Marketplace Globalist Quiz. And we welcome Stefan Richter, publisher and editor-in-chief of theglobalist.com. Good morning, Stefan.
Good morning, Steve. Are you ready for today's quiz?
I am ready. Bring it on.
So my question to bring on is, what share of global GDP do the world's 150 largest cities account for?
Ooh.
150 cities, metro areas, global GDP. Is it 20%? Is it 33%? Is it close to one-half or two-thirds of all economic activity around the world?
Well, 150 largest cities probably accounts for a lot of people on Earth. So I'm going to say the highest number, two-thirds.
You are right.
Wow.
In the future.
In the future.
Currently, that's not correct.
Oh,
by the way,
goodness.
By the way, the 150
You got me all excited, Stefan. I was about to do a dance.
Well, and the 150 cities only account for 12% of the global population right now.
So I get, all right, I get another choice here. Let's try half.
Half is correct.
Hey!
So it's four times more than the global population share of cities, which shows you what centers of urban activity and economic activities those cities are. The top growers among those, however, are increasingly from Asia, China, Latin America, and so on, which shows that urban areas are becoming much more important, especially in the emerging market areas, rather than just in the old world like Europe and the United States.
So many.
So the dynamism goes global, and at some point it may be two-thirds. Definitely by 2030, 60% of the world's population will live in urban areas with amazing environmental and infrastructure pressures that that involves.
An urbanized planet, exactly. All right. We thank you, Stefan Richter from The Globalist.
Good to have been with you.
To the well-known floor of the New York Stock Exchange now. Steve, thanks to computerized trading, as you know, it's becoming less of a trading floor and more of a TV set
it's
every
very
day.
Very fashionable, yes.
Very fashionable. Well, now the NYSE is renovating so it can actually be more attractive to party planners.
Oh.
It wants to double the number of events, I don't know, weddings, bar mitzvahs, whatever, that are held there to about 1,000 a year.
Bris.
That might be a step too far.
Maybe so.
That it appears the market has spoken, Steve, and it's saying, bye-bye blue chips, hello chips and dip.
Oh, how about blue chips and dip?
Those red hot blues.
Yeah,
there,
absolutely.
You go. If you are still interested, by the way, podcast listener, in the financial side of Wall Street, you can check out our new Wall Street blog. It's by our New York Bureau Chief, Heidi Moore, and it's at marketplace.org.
It's a great blog. Yeah, it's a place to go and check things out. We got to look at March retail sales this morning. Here's the headline. Consumers spent more, but mostly because of higher gasoline prices. The national average for a gallon of gas is about $3.80 a gallon. We're getting close to where we were at peak prices way back. Well, way back. It was only a few years ago in 2008.
So how are consumers reacting this time? Let's bring in LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus. Good morning.
Morning, Jeremy.
So is there a difference between the way that consumers reacted to high gas prices back in 2008 and the way that they're reacting today?
It's a big difference. Back in 2008, we didn't really see a big drop-off in driving. We did see use of public transportation going up, but I don't think the roads were any less congested at that time, whereas now we're actually seeing gas sales going down. They're down for the past 5 weeks, and the indication is that as gas prices keep going up, consumers will keep stepping back.
And why is that happening this time?
I would say it's because the recession is still fresh in people's mind. The wounds are still fresh, and people remember what it's like to have a cash crunch. And so they're trying to get ahead of the curve by looking for ways to economize in advance. Now, it's interesting because retail sales are still up. People are not cutting back across the board, but they are cutting back on their driving.
So people are actually going to the stores more now, but they're spending less on gas.
Yeah, but it's a little more complicated. I think we can assume that people are carpooling. I think we can assume that people are using public transit more. But I think we also have more fuel-efficient vehicles on the road right now. Back in 2008, there were probably more Hummers and more Escalades and more things like that around. Now we're seeing a lot more hybrids on the loose. That also is having a big impact on gas sales.
People are actually going out and buying hybrids and Volts and all that stuff?
They are doing that. And yet public transportation is a very strong going concern. And I think this is a real opportunity for transit operators around the country to try and offer an alternative to driving that is realistic and practical and convenient, and yet transit operators nationwide are cutting back on service even as gas prices head north.
LA Times consumer columnist David Lazarus, thanks so much.
Thank you.
To TV land now, Katie Couric is appearing this morning in her former home. She's promoting a new book in an interview with Matt Lauer on NBC's Today Show. There are rumors that the two of them are going to launch a new syndicated talk show together.
Oh, salacious, isn't it? Marketplace's Jennifer Collins tells us it's all part of a bigger story about the coming vacancy network TV has to fill.
It's Oprah. With Winfrey off to her cable channel, around 7 million viewers suddenly need a place to go, a place where advertisers will pay millions to reach them.
There is a chance for anything, really, to fill the vacuum.
Marty Kaplan is a media professor at the University of Southern California.
Katie Couric and Matt Lauer in principle could be that sexy thing that's exactly the right thing to lead into the local news.
The gamble would be that the duo could deliver enough viewers to offset their sizable salaries. Toby Miller is a professor of popular culture at the University of California, Riverside.
There's no doubt in my mind that teamed up again, they could bring back people in their mid-30s to daytime afternoon television and then perhaps perk them up for something later in the evening.
But right now, the Couric and Lauer program is still much more of a soap opera than it is a talk show. I'm Jennifer Collins for Marketplace.
And finally, China has released new restrictions concerning programming on television. And Jeremy, it is targeting time travel.
Time travel.
You know, there are a lot of censors over there in China.
Yeah.
They censor the internet and a lot of other things. Well, the censors there say dramas depicting characters going back in time lack positive thoughts and meaning. Not necessarily a ringing endorsement from the Chinese government,
yeah.
I would say. But so for now, anyway, if you're headed to China, and hey, you're a jet setter, you go everywhere, right?
Australia. I've never been to China. Actually,
have you not?
But
that's the next thumbtack over
yeah.
there on the Jeremy Hobson map. If you're going there, you want to see a show like Quantum Leap with Scott Bakula. You remember
yeah.
that one? Or Back to the Future with
yeah.
Michael J. Fox? You best build your own flux capacitor and send yourself back to before those guidelines were put into effect.
That's
you know
right.
What I'm saying?
I don't know. 1952. What was the date?
55. They went back 30 years.
Well, you can go back in time and check out all kinds of things at our website, marketplace.org, although there are a lot of new things on that website, too, so you might want to go to the present version of marketplace.org. In Los Angeles, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm Steve Chiotakis. This is the Marketplace Midday Update.
And this is APM, American Public Media.